Actually,
would you do that? Turn on the mic, and it's one of those two keys. And the projector. Thank you very much.
I know, this one doesn't come out. There's a disc here, too.
Is it on the disc?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Just hang on a second. I'm trying to get it to come out. Uh-huh. Voila.
Uh-huh. Okay. Do you know Thomas Jorens? Thomas Jorens? Do you know him?
Give me some context.
Well, he does architectural history and criticism.
Where?
He's from Spain. I know that he does.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
I'm sure I'm mispronouncing his
Llorens,
name.
Yeah.
Llorens.
It begins with two L.
Right.
Which make an I. Of course I know him. He was even for a brief time the director of the Sofia, Reina Sofia Museum. And why? Is he here?
No, we just spent... We just read him for the class that I was just in.
Did you read him on Manfredo Tafur? Yeah.
Yes.
Great essay.
That's a tough essay to read, too.
What?
It's a tough essay to read. I've read it about four times. And I was the one who assigned it to the class.
Yeah.
Because we were trying to critique Tafur.
No, that's that old issue of AA.
On the methodology. You have a piece in there, too, actually.
I have a copy. I Como. I mean, otherwise you can...
Do you know how much I paid for that? I paid $80 for my copy of it. It's very expensive.
I have about 30 copies.
It's impossible to find. You should put them on eBay. It's impossible to find.
Oh, great. No, I'll bring a few. Exactly. Nothing at all. So, for instance, we discovered another thing. Another lady ran into me and she wanted to know something. And I gave her my bibliography and I published it in two different books in the late 90s on Asplund and Tehrani. Only one book, of course.
Oh, okay.
Again, you know, here we are. Okay, so give me a second. I have to.
And I'll go too.
Are yours, so you don't lose those. I'll just. Good morning. I would like to discuss a little bit the midterms and discuss them entirely for your benefit, because presumably you are going to take more midterms in your life. However, this requires a little bit more reflection than I was able to muster this week. What I would like to encourage you to do with regard to the paper that you're doing is to come and either talk to Britt or talk to me, unafraid of eventual differences, of course, that might result from a talk with both of us. I think that's a great opportunity that you have, whether you pick one or the other, strategically or inadvertently, or it's not no pick at all. We're certainly not picky about this, are we? No, I mean, you just come and discuss briefly with us how you want to handle your paper. I would only say two or three sentences about it fundamentally. Preferably write about something that you know, or at least that you know something about, or that you've had a chance to experience. This experience could be of different nature. It could also be, in some sense, mediated, of course, like many experiences are. But ideally, it ought to be something where there is some flesh on the bone, as it were, that you're not totally depending only on the same kind of images that you may glean from any book or from the screen you just read.
How should we arrange the meeting with you and Brett?
This is what is called a problem of communication infrastructure or information highway and byway and so forth. We are here. We're here, and you're moving about. I feel very stationary from about 10:15, depending on train, on Wednesday until the later afternoon of Friday. You can also send me an email, because I've not had the security clearance. You have to send the email, Hotmail, to me, which is KurtWForster, one word, @hotmail.com. I read it every day, but I don't have the Yale dog tag, so you can't send me to Edu. No, I mean, I'm beyond educational control. Brit has, of course, his genuine, authentic tribal address, and therefore you can reach him too. Both of us.
When do you have office hours typically?
Well, I'm always sitting in my office, you know. I mean, so that makes, except occasionally I have to go out because it gets too hot or too cold, or somebody else is using the only hotline to the world. And of course, being strategically deprived of having lunch on the days that I'm here, because I'm always working over lunchtime, I'm either in class or in my office virtually. That's it. But you can post to me a note. You can stop me in the corridors. You can drop by and check, or leave me an indication. It doesn't seem to have been a great problem. As I said, with regard to the paper, preferably address something that you have some experience of, or that you have had a chance to somehow ponder, let's put it that way, in a direct fashion. Address and spell out at the beginning a particular thing that you're interested in, something that you would like to clarify in the effort of writing this short but thoughtful paper. Only I in my lectures are allowed to wander and to let you guessing what it's really about until maybe the next week, you know. I warn you, I will come back to most things, and in the end, if you think this was all a tremendously unraveled rug, you will miraculously, come the beginning of December, see this rug reassemble into patterns which are carefully hatched and which you've already begun to stitch in the midterm, etc. But you shouldn't take that as a model. You should take as a model something that has more rhyme and reason to it, that is more coherent, more pragmatic, more realistic, more direct in its address to reality. After all, what I would like to do here is let you see the shadows that pass under the clouds as much as I want to see the sunlight, but you will exercise the brightest rays of your intelligence, the clearest of your capacity to put things in a comprehensible and persuasive order. So in order to do that, you have to spell out something. Well, I tried to do it in a very modest way in the midterm by asking you questions. Most of you were extremely generous with what you knew and immediately released the entire flock of birds on the subject. I was merely asking for one or another to lay an egg, you know, or to so forth. So it's a very interesting experience, which we'll talk about next week, because it's something very interesting. You did so much more work than I expected you would do. Now, with a paper, I think you can kind of get down to the core of the business, as it were, spell out a question. It can be a question that, let's say, is more immediate, perhaps more pragmatic in its orientation. You know, why is this building so insufferably complex, or why is this building so intolerably simple, or what in this building makes for that or this, or what has this architect got to do with that or the other? And you never spell out a question and try to answer it. Of course, in the process, never forgetting that to answer a question is really to address what's in the question rather than to sort of merely turn the matter around and answer the question by reversing the sentence, which is also interesting, of course. We've decided that you need, of course, as much time as you can get, but then we also need some time to carefully read your papers. So we thought that the 12th of December, an apostolic date in the 12th month of the year, would probably be a reasonable, just, and appropriate day for the delivery, the final and binding delivery of this. By clicking on the 12th of December, you actually agree to deliver. Right. So this can't be one of those elephant babies or something that comes later, because we're all going to be in other places thereafter. Today, I have to admit to yet another imperfection. While the bank of images is widening and growing, and probably in a remote future will constitute a very useful repertoire of pictures, today's I have to click on, as I scroll through the register that's on this particular CD, because everybody was so busy in the last 24 hours that actually nobody got around to order them ahead of time in the way you would want them. But I think that it really doesn't matter. You know, already in the late 1950s, Karlheinz Stockhausen wrote 11 piano pieces, which the pianist can play in whatever order he wants to play it, or she wants to play it. And this is a little bit like this. I will pick my order, but it could be just as well another one. I will address the subject of what I've, again, in my usual obfuscating manner, titled The Urban Avatars. One of the problems with Frank Lloyd Wright's projects of high-rise buildings, even if they were no higher than the Johnson Wax Research Tower, did you recall perhaps from last time in Racine, Wisconsin, done, finished only after the war, it was their location at a remove from major urban centers. The problem was really that they were in the places they were in. He had made plans for a massive commercial structure in Chicago, and this is what you have on the screen, and late in life, an all-surpassing proposal for a so-called mile-high skyscraper. Curiously, nothing came of either of these projects during his lifetime. And although Wright tried his level best to break into the business of skyscrapers, he even moved to New York for a couple of years, living in the Waldorf Hotel, vainly trying to obtain commissions that might lead to landmark buildings, such as the Woolworth building, finished a year before the First World War broke out, but that's, of course, not a landmark here in America, because America was not involved in 1914 as the European nations were. In 1913, the Woolworth building finished. Then, of course, the Empire State, the Chrysler building, and others. Here, just for your delectation, of course, one can click on the Empire State building to recall the fact that very quickly after the First World War, the New York skyline and the skyline of a small number of other cities began to change dramatically with the appearance of such structures. All Frank Lloyd Wright ever achieved in this domain was, of course, that Price Tower in God-forsaken Bartlesville in Oklahoma.
But again, the problem is the same. This is too far beyond the horizon of urban history at this point. But he did try hard with a remarkable project, the one that you had before, and I'll get it back to you, for the National Life Insurance Company in Chicago in 1924, where he stacked up prisms in the vertical, you know, getting smaller as they shed vertical slabs, so to speak, only the central one, and like a coxcomb on the central one, only machinery and service element forming a crest, finally, on top of these slabs that are placed at a rather modest distance from one another, and ranged up against a continuous vertebral wall in the back, a continuous slab behind them with elevators and machinery housed in it. So that you got this curious evocation of something which partly suggests a cruciform or a comb-shaped plan, and at the same time, individually, is like an array of different buildings that might as well be freestanding. So he treated the facades, as you can see in this drawing, according to his then preoccupation. The major preoccupation in the early 1920s was with so-called textile blocks. That is to say, facades and entire walls towards the in and to the outside, more or less identical, built up from pre-cast blocks, partly perforated, partly glazed, partly opaque, partly solid, partly perforated, and a system of a kind of whoop and dwarf of reinforcing rods that held in place and with cement formed into a tissue-like wall, the so-called textile block wall, that he employed in a variety of houses in California, in particular in his 20s. He transferred this approach, more in appearance than in substance, of course, for buildings of this kind, to the National Life Insurance Company building, but he chose polished copper and glass as an infinitely variable and, of course, optically very active sheathing of these highly composite buildings. Chicago hardly needs to be recalled, of course, was the city where the skyscraper had been given its canonical shape in the ending years of the 19th century by Burnham and Root, Adler and Sullivan, and others, you recall, focused attention on this new category of building and produced in a kind of incredible, almost spontaneous, within 2 or 3 years, a spontaneous burst of buildings, a great variety, as you recall, ranging from such old-timers as the Monadnock building in solid masonry, really straining at the limits of its technology, to new buildings that radically and consistently based on the steel frame construction now allowed not only for new heights and a new flexibility of internal distribution, but also made for a completely different issue with respect to the facades, the cladding and sheathing of these buildings. It was then the Chicago Tribune Tower competition of 1922, to which we have alluded at one point or another before, that this interest in this category of building was instantly and dramatically focused. I'm not sure whether it's in this bank of pictures, because I'm now getting to the building that most irritated Brit. And it's not. Can you pull up Adolf Loos's Chicago Tribune Tower? Yes. Of course, you might recall the Chicago Tribune Tower entry, 1922, by Gropius, and that famous photograph where he is proudly placing himself at the side of the elevation perspectival drawing of the tower. You might recall that. Thank you. Thanks very much.
And then after that, I'll have to spring back. Maybe you stay near the kidney machine. Yes. You might recall that, of course, Gropius was only, along with Adolf Loos, one of numerous European architects that participated in this competition. And if Gropius might be cited as one whose project was passed over in silence, we have only to think of the winner of the second prize. You recall that vaguely Gothic spire that Eliel Saarinen submitted, and that prompted him to emigrate from Finland, where he had been a very successful architect, to the United States. And we remember Cranbrook and what came of that. But the entry that really has puzzled historians and critics the most is Adolf Loos's project for what was billed as the world's most beautiful and most memorable office building. That was part of the brief. It consists of a massive, three times setback base, a kind of enormous raised pedestal with a setback pyramid on top of it, from which springs an enormous fluted Doric column and an abacus on top of the column. Now, this project has been called many things. A Dadaist, a gratuitous act, an objet trouvé, a serious slip of taste, the harbinger of postmodernism, or simply an aberration. I think it is none of the above. Or perhaps, if you want, it is all of them at once. You know, of course, of Loos's Anglophile disposition, of his extended stay in Chicago, making him one of the very few, if not the only, European participant in the competition who had actually a solid first-hand experience of the city of Chicago. And his eccentric, but perhaps perceptive turn of mind is what comes with the project, too. He knew the city's history, having experienced it during the preparations for the World's Columbian Exposition. You remember that moment in 1893. Two decades before that event, Chicago had burned to the ground, its catastrophic conflagration triggering one of the biggest building booms in American history in the 19th century. One could really say, without exaggeration, that Phoenix-like, the skyscrapers and the large commercial complexes like the Auditorium building by Adler and Sullivan and others were born of the ashes of the city of Chicago. Now, could you give us back the other one? You memorized this one, of course. There have been other great fires in the history of cities, of European cities in particular, but few of the extent and the lasting impact of the Great Fire of London in 1666. The city of London was literally consumed, and its rebuilding propelled such extraordinary figures as the later Sir Christopher Wren to the forefront of architectural history. Wren, you might recall, was a mathematician before he became an architect. Wren's churches, by the dozen, sprang up in every borough of the city of London after the fire. And of course, his central church of St. Paul's marked London as St. Peter's marked Rome. Or the Pantheon was later to leave its mark on the cityscape of Paris. So after the fire, Wren quickly developed plans for a new city, organized by wide avenues converging in squares of different shape. This sounds strange, but in the English language, it is like that. Haste and speculation swept these plans aside. The pressure was simply too great to allow for such considerate, highly organized, and sequenced activity. But there was one spot, at least, in the city of London that was reserved for the commemoration of this event. Now, we will get there, just a second. Well, this is my picture recently taken.
It is in focus in the original. I don't know what it looks like from you, more or less.
In the modern city, at the edge of the modern city, this is not far from Tate Modern Gallery, you can see, and I point to it in my usual pantomime, getting habituated to what is a kind of a grandiose ruin of technology, right? We're living in here in a place that at the seams is showing us that it belongs, in a sense, to another age. And we're still living with one leg in that age, so I'm gesturing towards these things wildly in my emotive attempt to draw them near to you and to deliver them to you on a silver platter. There, in the midst of the city edge in London, you can see that strange column rise, and were it not for the totally gilt topping, you might have more difficulty distinguishing it from the cityscape today than with it. And of course, on top you can see that square or quadrangular balcony, because you can go up the many steps. You'll get a certificate with a stamp if you want when you come down again, that you've been on top there on this balcony. You can look out over the city. Now, what is this thing that survives in the jumble of buildings in modern London? Well, I said it was the spot reserved in the city for commemoration, for a memorial to its inhabitants. And it is called on every subway map of London, the Monument. Actually, one could now develop very interesting reflections with regard to the Twin Tower situation and those befuddled and bewildering attempts to create a site of memorial and to match that up with the real estate and commercial interests so dense in that particular area. Many similar things that can be said about Wren's London not coming about could be said about the plans for the commemoration of the catastrophic collapse of those two buildings. Very interesting what then distinguishes the nature of the monument in London from or any attempts at monumentalizing or commemorating such an event. What is absolutely common in both instances, one was a natural, both were man-made catastrophes, of course, if of very different nature, is that you commemorate a catastrophe. A very modest little square of which little remains today because of the total change of everything else around, was set aside on the major north-south axes, linking up with the Blackfriar Bridge that you can see in its modern incarnation over the Thames on the left, to identify that spot as both within the geography of the city, but singular, unique, and exempt, in a certain sense, from that geography of the city. We can look a little closer. You can see this a little better. I don't know which one of these might actually give you a better picture, but perhaps this one does. Now, one could add a number of important observations to this. Why is this column where it is? Why is it the height it is? And what was its originally intended shape? Let me fill you in merely in very, this is all related, by the way, to laws you will see in the end. A little bit in it, the monument placed, of course, at that ideal crossroads between the north-south axes running over the Thames and the east-west axes entering and originally intended to now bisect the rebuilt old city of London down to the Tower. So this was a new center, a new prick mark on the map of London after the fire. The height of the building is determined by the distance of that site from the kitchen in which this fire started, originated in a kitchen, in a greasy spoon, and from there spread for days, devastating the rest of the city. So what Wren did is take this new we could say, umbilicus, this new navel of the city, this new central point, and calculated from the horizontal distance on the ground between the kitchen where the fire started and the bottom of the column. Then taking that distance and raising it into the vertical, exactly. And describing on an inscription, which here you see the king with the architect with a reconstructed with a scaffolding on the right-hand side, and on the other side is an elaborate inscription that defines exactly this operation of taking the distance from the source of the fire, raising it into the vertical, determining thereby the height of the column, and fitting the column with gilt bronze flames. Every single ridge of this fluted column would have had between 8 and 12 flame-shaped metal sheets attached to it, so that under the constantly changing light, and you know this is England, there is never 2 minutes of the same light or the same weather, right? You would have approaching from wherever this column, you would have seen it flicker literally in front of you under the unstable light of day and the sunlight as a kind of column of fire in the midst of the city, because it was to commemorate this disaster of the fire, and it was to be a warning. It was to admonish the citizen of what? Of the ultimate fire which will terminally consume the world. This is the purpose of the monument. So it sets a catastrophe that was real and enormous in a perspective which is the perspective of human destiny and salvation, right? Which is the perspective of the destiny of the creation. Now, if you consider these circumstances, and I won't go back because this is getting to be too cumbersome, to Lawes's project. If you consider these circumstances, then I think it's no longer a surprise that Lawes chose the design he did. I make it as simple almost as an equation. London burned down, a monument erected in London is there to mark a new beginning in the history of the city, knowing full well that this new beginning is like an installment in a process of destruction and reconstruction of the city that, in a sense, cyclically articulates the ultimate destiny of the world. Chicago burned down in 1871. For Dearborn's Edge was exactly at the bridge over the Chicago River where the Chicago Tribune Tower was constructed, was to be constructed. So fire, destruction, and rebirth. Fire, destruction, and rebirth. What is very physical and what is very immediate in the experience of the monument in London, had it been fully fitted and finished in the way Wren intended it, by the way, an absolutely fantastic idea, of course, in Lawes's project, is turned into what was the headquarters at the edge of the new city of Chicago for the newspaper. In other words, it is communication technology, it is the media by which we continually remind ourselves of all the things that happen in the world, of all the catastrophes that befall mankind, and of what may be our historic, inescapable fate. Now, what you could say, and of course this is wide open to criticism, is that Lawes makes one of those astounding direct transpositions from a great historic monument in a country he loved, whose culture he admired, for another country he loved, whose culture he also admired, although recognizing well the differences, and he wanted to give to Chicago the monument that already, in a sense, existed in London. So what fire and later firebombs did to European cities, American cities had to do unto themselves. The cheap shots aimed at the empty lots and devastated neighborhoods of some American cities after urban renewal, so-called, find obviously an obvious target. Why do the building stock, due to the, sorry, this is very strange, I have to look a second time. why do to the building stock what is really aimed at its inhabitants? Why remove people and reallocate urban territory to other activities when other options could be considered? Why act by dint, for instance, of federal legislation and titles indispensable to the last 45 or so years, or more, almost 50, of urban renewal, renovation, model cities, activity in numerous American cities. Why act then by dint of federal legislation in such discreetly local contexts, otherwise so fiercely protective of their own nature and difference from others? Well, many more such questions could, of course, be asked. I ask them somewhat rhetorically, you will see in a moment, because they underlie a number of major operations that we are looking at. From the start, the sighting of major urban interventions in the U.S. occurred in this context of what is called urban improvement or urban renewal. Replacing so-called blighted neighborhoods with entirely new ones, usually by excluding the neighbors that inhabited them in the first place, represents a consistent dimension of these initiatives. They are by no means dead, although lately much more contained and scaled down. Instead of actually rehabilitating a neighborhood in the sense of term, namely improving it, such clearing of urban sites in order to make room for new commercial and also cultural ventures must be considered a systemic strategy. Inner urban areas have traditionally been, for instance, photographed with what I would call a pseudo-ethnographic eye that adds acute or commiserating tinge to images of poverty and dereliction. I now have to do this thing again here, because I had out of popular books a number of pictures taken which show you exactly this. If I can find them, that really rather curious mixture of images. Here we go. I say pseudo-ethnographic because it feigns a distance from what you can see, but is so near to you that you can brush it with your coat. It's kind of an exorcising image, and by representing what you don't want to see, in a sense, you can make it go away. Office girls shown having a frugal lunch, elderly apple vendors and cripples peddling pencils, fiddlers in the street, and unemployed waiting in bread lines around the block, or the secretaries after their frugal fast lunch gaining presumably a moment of liberty to play bridge. This is the kind of stuff of the picture reportage which is rendering so insidious the conditions in the cities, in many cities after the First World War. Not that the conditions would be that new, but they were certainly rendered much more acute by what was happening after the war. The reverse of the medal belongs, of course, to the images of the shining city, the lure of the metropolis that became the destination for the huddled masses seeking their fortune in the new world. And, of course, this aspect of the city is best appreciated from afar, at a distance, across the water, or from the giddying heights of skyscrapers. I even have a picture of that, if I can find it, just so you don't think I'm making it all up, as I usually do. But here you are, even by Louis Hine, one of the best photographers of the working man and of labor conditions in the 20th century history of the United States, late 19th, early 20th century here, from the dizzying heights of work still underway at the top parts of the Empire State Building. It is really here distance that becomes the key for understanding. From well above the melee, the city life is no longer personal, but it becomes purely symbolic. Vapors and smoke swirling around the mountains of buildings, sunlight bursting over their silhouettes, and I had that one too, give me a second. Jesus Christ, this is all awkward. I mean, forehand piano playing is a snap compared to this sort of thing. Of course, in this kind of bursting aluminum sheathing on top of the Chrysler Building, the emphasis, the singular emphasis on silhouette, on distant impact and so forth, and of course, best of all, the emphasis on electric light emanating from these obelisks and pyramids at night. Now, I had one of those too, but I won't detain you too much, but you know the nighttime pictures that that of course become a category all to themselves, become indispensable to this sort of mirage of the modern city. Don't do me the favor, but tant pis. Now, it was precisely electricity that changed everything, and the nighttime city became its best billboard. In fact, in a word, one could say nightlife became electrifying. Now, in the case of the Rockefeller Center, which is what I am trying to illustrate to you, and then I have to get here in a second, so we know what we're looking at. In the case of the Rockefeller Center, which covers an area between 49th Street and 52nd Street, bordering on 5th and 7th Avenue, was primarily a mixed-use area. It was precisely the area where you would have found the apple peddler, you would have found the secretaries on their lunch break. It was an area of undistinguished stores lining the streets. It had, however, a number of theaters and, of course, fairly crowded apartments in 4- and 5-story buildings along the streets. It was in that kind of underbelly part, in that kind of soft midriff section of Manhattan that lacked any of what later came to be concentrated in the area. Such districts that covered major parts of Manhattan were usually called tenement districts. The theaters in the area that is above today's theater district, of course, it below Rockefeller Center, you do enter what remains of the theater district, may have suggested the original plan of relocating the Metropolitan Opera to this area. And it was John Rockefeller, as one of the main supporters of the opera, cast his eye on this particular area, no doubt because it was traditionally identified as a theater area. He was one of the main supporters of the opera, and it was him with a consortium of investors and entrepreneurs that leased the area from its owner, a famous slumlord, Columbia University. All that remained in the end of the original plan for the Metropolitan Opera was Radio City Music Hall, with its 3,500 seats and ultimate modernist stage machinery, allowing entire orchestras to rise from the pit while busily fiddling away. It is part of the first building, that was part of the first building to be completed and opened in 1932. I even have a view, of course, grandiose, almost in the style of future world exhibitions, the massive theater and its complex organization. When we look at the complex as a whole, you get an immediate sense of the magnitude of this enterprise. The consortium of developers under the leadership of Rockefeller interests leased the land and launched a project of really daunting dimensions, laid out by the guiding hand of Raymond Hood, so as to stake out its territory within the existing city while visibly transforming the geography of the site. This singular opportunity to organize an area of some 9 city blocks with respect to its internal articulation, not only with regard to its customary street side shapes, found a visionary source in the images that Hugh Ferris was drawing during the 20s and finally publishing in 1929, just on the eve of this enterprise, in a book of images titled The Metropolis of Tomorrow. Ferris populated the vast expanses of anonymous cities, which could, however, in their nature, extent, and shape only be American cities, with massive building complexes towering over the streets, invariably set back as they rise, as if New York zoning laws that they had been enacted in 1916 and prescribed a certain setback according to height were universal laws of architecture. In other words, Ferris, despite the visionary distance from reality in these projects, had more or less explicitly or perhaps unwittingly predicated them upon the New York Building Code. The ziggurat-like profile of these behemoths, the dark piles that puncture the sky and loom like soot-covered cliffs over the streets below, appear today to us as a kind of dark vision of the city, as a truly overwhelming, overpowering image of a heavy, dark, canyon-like cityscape. It would be difficult to divorce the reality of Rockefeller Center from its visionary counterpart, if you want. For an unexpected reversal is engendered by the comparison. Just as Ferris saw the city forever blackened by its industrial underbelly and the distant horizon blazing in light, as you can see it here, for instance, in this drawing, so Rockefeller Center wanted to create a city of light in the midst of the sooty and gritty reality of Depression-era New York. And in fact, I just passed late at night the other day, a shortcut which you can take because of this ingenious layout through Rockefeller Center. And suddenly you look up and the clouds and the rain, and there are all these moving searchlights on top that seem to represent that surfeit of energy and electricity literally emanating from the tip of the building. The monoliths that form Rockefeller Center were conceived as buildings made of slabs. From some angles, their surfaces appear merely striped in the vertical. From others, like a laminate of slabs with different profiles. I got, I think, another picture of this too. So as to reveal their sawtoothed profiles on top, recalling quite clearly and no doubt explicitly the project of Frank Lloyd Wright for Chicago in 1924. A certain similarity exists between the tightly packed layers of this National Life Insurance building with its stepped back wings, you might recall, and the staggered slabs, for instance, of the RCA building. But the center, the Rockefeller Center, embraces different models and incorporates a variety of not always compatible elements in a single, if huge, project. Typically, such a project results in its realization from the orchestrated efforts, a really major exercise of modern management applied to architecture, efforts of a consortium of architects. And the principal ones are Reinhardt and Hofmeister, Corbett, Harrison, and McMurray, Harrison later emerging as a key figure in other New York projects such as Lincoln Center, and of course Hood and Fulieu. Raymond Hood played a key role, but Rockefeller Center is composed of too many parts Its lifespan is too extended, and its modifications are too numerous over time to allow for a single unifying concept to prevail over everything else. It is as if somebody built with at a stroke all of New Haven in one go. Nor need there be such pervasive controls, for the center covers an area so large and accommodates activities of so many kinds that it can be thought of, as it was thought of, as a city within the city. And there are all these proud statistics published in the 30s and off even after the war that show that the consumption of water, the consumption of electricity, the number of people passing through, the quantity of garbage produced, and everything else amounts to the metabolic dimensions of an entire city. To mention only one aspect whose character was thoroughly changed, and for the better, the sunken plaza in the center of Rockefeller Center. As you enter between the two low-slung wings before in front of you that front on Fifth Avenue, Fifth Avenue is at the bottom of the image, and gently descend along a raised planting beds that grow taller as you descend, and a row of shops on both sides, you reach a sunken courtyard at the very center and at the very foot of the tallest building that was also ringed by shops. Now, let me quickly see. I think there was a picture of this somewhere. Anyway, if you really should know this for any number of reasons, but I'm afraid I can't show you that just this sunken courtyard, but it goes one story down and was ringed with shops. Now, the merchants located there failed quickly, and the open fulcrum of Rockefeller Center proved a commercial flop. I don't know who came up with the idea, but it was obviously an impresario with a streak of genius to put recently developed refrigeration technology to use and open an ice rink on the plaza. The site became an urban landmark and remains a destination for visitors to this day, lending a whiff of holiday air to a topographical sink in the midst of the city. A giant statue by sculptor Paul Manship, that's before you, floats over the sunken plaza. The gilt frame of a rather innocent-looking fellow comes with its own caption. I'm afraid, they took it, it's cut off the picture, I'm so sorry. Spelling the name of this fellow, and the name is Prometheus. In the hand of his extended arm, he holds aloft a flame, representing the power of the gods who clung to this prerogative, you might recall, withholding the quickening element of the fire from uncivilized hominids, we would call them today, the uncouth predecessors of mankind, mankind becoming mankind for the technology of the fire. Prometheus stole the fire of the gods and in an act of constructive rebellion gave the fire to humans, enabling them to use it in three different areas of their dark existence. Fire and its application enabled humans to practice agriculture, to engage in warfare, and, attention, to create architecture. Thus, the ancient mythographers and Renaissance historians of ancient mythology. While you may be skating to waltz tunes, or so it used to be at any rate, it's difficult to skate to techno music, remember you do so innocently at the feet of towering buildings and thanks to modern refrigeration equipment using heat. Overhead electricity excites the airwaves and turns night into day. The sunken plaza with its icing turns into a sacred site of electrotechnology before your very eyes. At the heart of Rockefeller Center lies communication. Not only was it the flagship of the Radio Corporation of America and its various subsidiaries, in short, It was Radio City and came to be known as such. It also provided an anchor to what is always in the air and everywhere, hence without a fixed point of origin. That point needed to be elaborately recreated in the shape of huge theaters, semi-automated performances, and broadcasts. Plucked into the throbbing life of the city, we take it for granted that the center be fully integrated with its precinct, connected on street level and below. Rockefeller Center was among the first places to have subway entrances that appear as domestic, if not more so, as any doorway to a building. Go today on 7th Avenue, you kind of slip into little narrow door, open doors, and go down the steps into. You pass underground between all the buildings forming composing the original complex. You pass exempt from car traffic on the platforms of these buildings. You can go down to the sunken ice rink. You can go up to the Rainbow Room and overlook the city. In other words, you can, within the city, create all of the nearness and all of the distance from it that was so definitive in the way the city is being perceived and experienced as a metropolis, as I said at the beginning. The struggling figure atop a pylon, and we got him too, voila. The struggling figure atop a pylon on Fifth Avenue facing St. Patrick's Cathedral is none other than Atlas himself, shouldering the globe and testing his stamina and resolve, just as the Rockefeller Center took on the Depression, took on the weight and dilemmas of the city, and tried at the heart of the city itself to shoulder its problems. I apologize for the slim pickings, but I hope you got something out of it nonetheless. Thank you.
Can everyone just listen for a minute? I'm going to dump the setup coordinator for the party tomorrow.
Oh, great.
Everyone knows what their job is, but I have no idea who they want to be whatsoever. I think it's
well, it simply didn't have time. I can't do it. I have to learn how to do it. And because part of the image, like the one that you picked up, I don't have on the disk. I will organize it such that Jake can do it all day. Well, I mean, you're busy in the morning. You were busy. Anyway, I think you can still see. You can see the.
Well, I don't know why it's 12.
But what is it? I've noticed that before. But it doesn't seem. I know it's not the fault of the original images from which it was scanned. I know.
I have it going back. Back there.
Oh, let me go.
Things are a little clear back there because they're not seeing the pixelation.
I don't know if everyone has something to do or not or whatever.
The whole point of the Tribune Tower, the way that I read it today, is that this